Business Brief, the most widely read business magazine in South Africa, brings you the Business Brief interview of the week.
Welcome back to Contemporary Business, and it's time now for our Business Brief excerpt. This has to be the best article I've read all year long in Business Brief. I think it's the most honest, it's the most direct, and quite frankly, it's the most disturbing of many of the other pieces that I've come across. Business Brief, as you know, is the number one online and in printed form business magazine here in South Africa. And there's a reason for it, and that's the quality of the authors of these thought leadership articles. I am joined on the line by Professor Leon van Vieren, who's executive director at the Ethics Institute. Professor, thank you so much for joining me here on Contemporary Business.
Good day, Ivor. Thank you for having me on your show.
Your article really pulls no punches in two different respects. The first is by looking at the practitioners of business ethics in the business place, and that's the managers, it's the business practitioners who on a daily basis run the gauntlet of right and proper. But more importantly, it looks at the culture of the business environment and what is ethical or so unethical about that business environment in terms of business practices. Why did you write this article?
I wrote this article because I have very strong views about the distorted type of capitalism that we find in this country. And we send mixed messages to, organizations send mixed messages to their stakeholders. On the one hand, they build a building that is worth 3 billion rand, and after having just retrenched perhaps 6,000 workers, or there's poverty all around, and then they build an organization, they erect a building of 30, 40 floors, that is like a middle finger to poverty.
What you're really saying is that it's impossible on the one hand to talk about increases in an industry while on the other hand talking about the retrenchment of people in that very same sector, that there is cognitive dissonance wherever you look in business practices. On the one hand, you're talking about having an economic crunch, and on the other hand, there's massive capitalization in terms of equipment and buildings. But isn't that traditional business prudent practice in terms of investment strategies, cost-cutting strategies? The mere fact that you move into a more modern building doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to cost you more at the end of the day, or is that wrong?
That is absolutely correct. However, it's often the timing of this. In a time where, firstly, on a macro perspective, during the time when there's really an economic crunch, I think one should really think about what organizations spend their money on. And I'll get back to this. But also the anomaly of some organizations not even showing profit, yet erecting buildings. A very low growth in the economy. I just think that money could be more wisely spent elsewhere. In a macro perspective.
So you start your article off by talking specifically about shareholders and the notion of shareholders cutting costs and heads. And I think you mention in your, well, the way you write in your article is very similar to something that Judge Mervyn King spoke to me about, and that's the level of disassociation that shareholders actually have from the people who work in the business, the people who manage the business, and importantly, the customers and suppliers into those businesses. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about, that shareholders are really oblivious to the realities on the ground?
Shareholders are, to an extent, oblivious. In a sense that if you think about it, boards and excos pander to the needs of shareholders to a large extent. And the underlying motive of business is to make money, and to show return on investment to the shareholder. So the shareholders, to a large extent, still dictate. I mean, the whole notion of the King IV report, the underlying premise of it, is really to moderate the negative effects of capitalism, which is shareholder greed. Which is not tempered as it stands yet. Although many organizations ascribe to King IV, the shareholder is still the most important stakeholder in many respects.
I think what you say in terms of labor relations and in fact the way you talk about retrenchments, where companies very often hide behind these fancy labels such as Section 189 processes rather than just saying we're about to retrench people, we want to engage in a retrenchment narrative with you, I think is very, very true. It's very often difficult for business managers and senior people in businesses to actually just call a spade and say, look, at the end of the day, this is what we're talking about, so that people can understand plainly and squarely and transparently what is going on. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that's such a disjuncture between managers and owners and shareholders of businesses and the people who work in those businesses to actually just talk the plain truth?
Well, I think it goes beyond just the plain truth. I think it is the attitude underlying executive thinking. Executive thinking is really about the income and expenditure and the balance sheet. And if you just look at the how removed they are from the employees often. Just think about the following. If you think of executives engage with each other only. I just need to find a quote. In my opinion, organizations leaders are sometimes completely isolated from their own company. They engage with the same person, listen to some and not to others, reward those who agree with them, and avoid those who challenge them. Such a disconnect causes leaders to brush off ethical failures, and so a culture of impunity prevails. However, let's go back to the attitude that I was referring to. The attitude, if you think of the words that I use to describe people in organization, they use words like assets or headcount. Now, the word headcount in itself dehumanizes people. And so it's easier to cut heads or to cut costs or to rationalize or to restructure or right-size than it is to retrench 600 human beings that have an effect on another 6,000 human beings and the rest of the economy. So I don't think there's a lot of sensitivity around the people aspect, the human resource in the organization. Organizations talk the big talk about human resources are our most important asset. Yet at the end of the day, that's the first point that they turn to when they need to cut costs.
One of the things that strikes me straight in the face, fat in the face, when I read your article is this notion, and that's degrees of separation. You talk in terms of customer relationships and the fact that companies very often delegate those customer relationships to nameless and faceless call center operators. I see this cultural problem happening, for example, in the corporate rental space, in the retail rental space as well, where tenants never ever get to see the owners of those shopping centers and always have to work through managing agents. It's like the opportunity to create those degrees of separation opportunities somehow neutralizes the responsibility to take and to treat your obligations towards your tenant or equally towards your customer in any serious way. And I think it's a critical problem. I pick it up completely in terms of your ethical dilemma that you point out in your article.
Yes, the degrees of separation, that's crucial. Because companies outsource the obligation of interacting and caring for their stakeholders by outsourcing those actions to others. The board outsources ethical obligations to the rest of the organization, and then they don't attend to their own ethical obligation, for example. So definitely there's that separation, but I call it outsourcing your obligations, and particularly your ethical obligations.
As far as the practitioners are concerned and their obligation to be ethical, you don't spend a huge amount of time talking about their personal obligations and sense of ethical values. Why is that? You certainly disproportionately, quite frankly, I think talk a lot about the culture and the fact you look cynically at the ethics of business from a cultural perspective. But as far as the practitioners are concerned, they seem to get off pretty lightly in your article. Is that intentional?
They do get off lightly in the sense that they, as I said, executives are, by practitioners, I understand that you mean the leadership in the organization. But they do get off lightly because they, and I'll give you, I'll put an example to this, either. If you show there's no dividend achieved in a particular year, and your share price is lethargic, yet you still pay bonuses or salary to your CEO that exceeds 50 million. There's something really, I think I think they get even away with too much in that sense, particularly in the area of executive remuneration.
And very finally, and I'm reminding you, dear listeners, I'm talking to Professor Leon van Vieren, Executive Director of the Ethics Institute. And this is a rollicking discussion on both corporate ethics as well as personal ethics. Finally, Professor, what you say about lifestyle audits is surprising. It's shocking. But quite frankly, I don't think any of us can take offense to what you're saying. And that's essentially, lifestyle audits in South Africa are useless because there is no consequence management in this country. So what if the lifestyle audit is conducted? So what if there's nefarious activity detected? There seems to be absolutely no follow-through in terms of consequence. You're quite adamant about that, aren't you?
I am, and I'd like to add something else to that, and that is the whole notion of conflicts of interest. The general practice in business is that to expect and to enforce declaration or disclosure of conflicts of interest or potential conflicts of interest. Yet declaring something it doesn't make it okay. In other words, organizations accept the declarations, for example, that I own a business who offers services to my own to the company that I'm employed by, and there's no consequence. In other words, there's no follow-up of the conflicts. It's all good and well to declare a conflict of interest, but the conflict still has to be managed. And I'll use an example in this regard. A number of years ago, the ex-MEC for Transport in KZN, Spoondebele, received a gift to a Mercedes-Benz to the value of R1 million from a consortium of transport companies. And when he approached the Parliamentary Ethics Committee to ask them what he should do after receiving a lot of pressure from the press, he came back and he responded that the committee said that I could keep the car as long as I declare it. So there's also this misperception that declaring and disclosing is enough. And then people sit back and do not manage it. And then, of course, it escalates into real disastrous situations for organizations.
The silence in response to what you're saying is explosive. Professor, it's been an absolute pleasure and a privilege chatting to you. Thank you so much for coming on to Contemporary Business with me.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.